This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Seth Rogen was only 17 when he got his first big break, a role on the TV series Freaks and Geeks, produced by Judd Apatow. Too bad it was canceled before the end of the first season. So is Rogen's next series with Apatow, Undeclared. But they reunited for a string of big hits, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, and Superbad, which Rogen also co-wrote. Rogen co-wrote and stars in the new film Pineapple Express, a funny hybrid of a stoner film and action film. Rogen plays Dale Denton, a process server. While parked outside the home of someone he's about to serve with a subpoena, he witnesses the guy being murdered. Not wanting to be discovered, Dale drives away, but he accidentally drops some telltale evidence, the very potent marijuana Pineapple Express, which is sold only by one dealer, his. So the killers know how to find Dale and his dealer, Saul Silver, played by James Franco. Rogen and Franco first worked together on Freaks and Geeks. Here's a scene from Pineapple Express just before the murder. Dale is at his dealer Saul's place, smoking and buying Pineapple Express before heading to his next assignment. Saul is surprised to see Dale so professionally dressed.
What's up with the suit?
Oh, I'm a process server, so I have to wear a suit.
Wow. You're a servant? Like a butler? A chauffeur?
No. What? No, I'm not like... No, I'm
Shine
a,
shoes?
I'm a process server. I like...
In process.
I work for a company that's like hired by lawyers to like hand out legal documents, like subpoenas to people who don't want them, so I gotta wear like disguises sometimes just to make them admit that they're themselves so I can serve them the papers.
Disguise?
Kind of, I guess. It's a hell of a job.
That's cool, man.
Like a day-to-day basis, it's fine. Like,
you got a great job where you don't do anything?
That's what I say.
I wish I had that.
Are you... You do. You have the easiest job on earth.
That's true.
You didn't think of that.
No. I do have a good job.
Yeah, you do nothing.
Thanks, man.
No problem.
Seth Rogen, welcome to Fresh Air. What are some of the possibilities you saw in the idea of an action film with two stoners as the heroes?
You know, it just kind of seemed like a funny way to explore action movies, I guess. I mean, I'm a big fan of them always, and... you know, it's always people who are very equipped to deal with the situations that they're thrown in. So the notion just seemed funny because it's like basically stoners are kind of the last guys in the world who are equipped to deal with that. And the humor possibilities just seemed somewhat endless.
So you had to go through the action scenes playing stoned, not quite as stoned as James Franco has to play.
Yes.
So what kind of challenges did that present for you, you know, being stoned and then getting, you know, shot at and taking on wild car rides and you know, chase scenes, all the standard action stuff?
It was pretty easy, I got to say, because... I thought, you know, going in, you know, we knew, like, two major things happen to you when you get stoned. You know, you either get, like, really stupid or you get really paranoid. And Franco was kind of representing the stupid, and I was kind of representing the paranoid. And it's easy to act paranoid when you're in a car chase because it's actually really scary. But, you know, when we shot, though, we actually shot a lot of different levels of stonedness. And then in the editing room kind of modulated how high... we wanted us to be. It's the most thought anyone has ever put into two stoned idiots being on screen, I would say.
Did you play it like you are when you're stoned, or did you play it like a different character would be when he's stoned?
Honestly, when I'm stoned, I don't act very stoned at all, or so I think. But, you know, I would try to kind of recall times when I was extremely stoned, when I was younger mostly, and I would do stupid things to get stoned, like smoke cross-shaped joints. That kind of puts you into another level that I don't really go anymore, just because I don't know how I would handle that. But, yeah, I definitely I drew some from personal experience, I would say.
Yeah, you mentioned the cross joint. I have to confess, I'd never seen one of those before. I wasn't sure if you made it up for the film or whether they... actually
we
exist in real life.
They do. We actually smoke. That's like a party trick in high school, you know, like I guess it's like the weed equivalent of like a beer bong or something like that.
You gotta describe it.
It's one large joint that has a hole punctured in it, and then a smaller joint is kind of threaded through that hole, and it makes two intersecting joints that are shaped like a cross. And the key is that you can't see. For anyone, I don't know how many people that listen to NPR want to roll a cross joint in their own. The key is to puncture the smaller joint with a hole also, so you can suck through that. But it's ridiculous. There's no need to do it other than to see if you can do it. And you can. It's very possible.
There's a lot of action scenes in the film that are obviously inspired by action movies. What was one of the classic scenes you wanted to try yourself? Like, there's one scene where you have to jump from a balcony. I think it's onto Gary Cole, who's who's one of the villains. And that's such a classic scene. Like, tell me the action film that doesn't have that kind of jump.
Dramatic
on it.
Leap.
Yeah. So what are the things you wanted to, like, do that you've seen in other action films?
Well, one of the big things that we wanted to do was trying to kick out a car window as you're driving after it's been shattered, you know, obstructing your view. I mean, I can't count how many movies I've seen that in. And we just thought, you know, like, it could be funny if it just kind of goes wrong and his foot just kind of punctures through the window and gets stuck. And, you know, we just kind of wanted to play with these iconic moments in action. There's a really small one that always makes me laugh really hard where there's a big shootout at the end, and the moment my gun runs out of bullets, I turn and there's just another gun sitting there, and I'm like, oh, nice. To me, that always it's like so convenient, and, you know, they never run out of bullets in action movies, unless it's at the most dramatic time possible.
And you had, this is your first movie we had to carry a gun, right?
It in Superbad, I carry a gun, but I didn't get to shoot it.
Oh,
that
that's true, because you're a cop. Yeah, of course. And you carry it very irresponsibly. Yeah,
I do, but in this, there was like a week straight of shooting where, like, all I did was shoot a machine gun, and I hate to, it went every against all my Jewish and Canadian instincts, but I enjoyed every second of it.
When you were growing up, could you physically defend yourself as a kid, and did you ever need to?
I did. I did karate for a really long time, almost 10 years when I was younger. And I was always big. I was kind of around this size, like, since I went into high school. I played rugby and stuff like that. So people, you know, would screw with me, but I never gotten, like, to a real fight or anything like that.
Why'd you take karate?
My friends did it. Sammy and Evan took it. It was at the Jewish Community Center. It was just really something to do. I was really into martial arts movies and stuff like that. You know, I liked action movies. Jean-Claude Van Damme was a major influence on me at that point in my life. So I thought, you know, what better thing to do than learn karate at the Jewish Community Center?
So how far did you get? What belt?
I was like a brown belt, which is pretty good. I entered a tournament once, and I punched a guy in the throat and got disqualified. I realized, I don't know if you're familiar with Karate Kid, but the bad guys in that are called Cobra Kai, and they're like the evil karate guys. And when I went to the tournament, I realized that's what we were. We were like the Cobra Kai of the Jewish karate community.
Now, the stunt coordinator that you used on Pineapple Express has done some pretty serious stunt work. He worked on a Jet Li film, The Italian Job, Speed, Jurassic Park. Did you need someone that good for a comedy?
We thought it would be, you know, funnier if the action was kind of serious and not that funny and handled, you know, and obviously we would be funny reacting to it, but we wanted the, you know, the stunts themselves to be as close to what an actual action movie is as humanly possible. So we thought, yeah, let's hire a real stunt guy, you know, and it makes the movie, I think, a lot funnier, more exciting, and you really feel like we're in danger.
What is the most ridiculous position you were in making the movie and putting yourself in actual jeopardy to film a stunt?
I mean, you always get hurt in ways that you don't think you're going to. There was always little awkward things that would happen. Like, there's a big scene where me and James and Danny McBride have a fight in Danny McBride's character's house, and it kind of goes on for a really long time, and we destroy the entire house. And there's like a kind of simple shot where I'm like crashing through a coffee table and I almost broke my finger and I had to go to the hospital and I had like a splint on it. And that was relatively easy. But meanwhile, when you're leaping off like a 40-foot balcony suspended from wires, that's like the, you know, that's the easy day of shooting. You just have to sit there. They swing you around on wires. It really hurts your groin, but no serious injury is possible.
So since you play stoners in so many films, tell us about the first time you got high and what the experience was like.
I was pretty young. I guess I was in high school, so I was probably 13 years old, at the time, I'd just gotten into high school, and there was these kind of railroad tracks near high school. One of my friends bought a bag of weed, and, you know, I'd never really even seen weed at that point, and, you know, you picture it being this kind of, like, leafy oregano-like substance always. I guess that's because, like, that's what you see in movies, kind of like this big, huge bag, you know, this green stuff that looks like, you know, lettuce almost. And what he had was one, like, little bud that was probably, like, the size of, like, you know, a marble that had been squished down as much as humanly possible. And so it almost looked like a, like, it was, like, a, the shape of, like, a quarter or something like that. And we really just didn't know what it was. We're like, how is this weed? Like, it was hard as a rock. It had clearly been in someone's pocket for a really long time. Now, in retrospect, I can recognize that what that is a little bud that's been in someone's pocket for too long. Or someone's book bag, and there's been a science binder on it all day. But it was squished down, and we rolled a really crappy joint out of it because we didn't know what to do. It was so hard. You know, now I would know you would need a grinder or scissors or something like that. But at the time, we didn't know, and then we smoked it, and it did absolutely nothing. And then the next weekend, though, we actually smoked it properly, and I got more stoned than I've ever been in my entire life.
And what was that experience like? Yeah,
it was crazy. I remember it very vividly. I remember it was actually kind of horrifying because one of my friends, we smoked out of a bong. That's why we got really high for the second time. And one of my friends, this is so stupid, he didn't want to bring, it was after school on a Friday, and we smoked weed in this park called the Ravine that was right across the street from my high school. And he didn't want to bring the bong back home with him. We were going to walk back to his house and hang out. He didn't want to bring it there, so he wanted to go back into school and put the bong in his locker and leave it in there. And I was like, dude, I was so paranoid and high and scared. I was like, we can't go back into school. Like, that's the last place we should go into school. Are you kidding me? And he was just like, no, I'm just going to put it in my locker. No one will know. No one will know we're high. He had smoked pot before a few times. And I lost my mind. And I was like, we can't go back in there. And they just went in anyway. And I remember thinking, we're traveling through time. I remember keep thinking that. And then he put it back in and everything was fine. And we went back to his place. We ate a lot. And we wrestled in his room, I remember, and one of my friends tripped over a beanbag chair and hurt his head, and it sobered us up completely.
So how did you meet Evan Goldberg?
I met Evan at bar mitzvah class. It was called Tullison Tefillin. Every day after, maybe not every day, a few days a week after school, all the Jews that went to that temple would converge and learn of their Haftorahs and whatnot. And him and Fogel were in my bar mitzvah class. And we became great friends. Once, you know, you're in bar mitzvah class with people, they got to invite you to their bar mitzvah. So we got invited to dozens and dozens of bar mitzvahs. And there was a year straight where every weekend I went to at least one bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah. And we would all go, and it was a lot of fun. We'd sneak some beers. We'd hang out. We would try to get with girls and not. And usually we'd just end up hanging out together alone. But we became good friends.
So going to bar mitzvah class with Evan Goldberg, how did you realize that you could write together?
I really never, when I first met him, I don't know what made me think. He was just a funny guy, obviously. He was a lot goofier back then. He was a pretty goofy kid. He was like one of those kids you look at and you're like, oh, that's like, that kid, something's not working out quite right with that kid. Like, his clothes never fit right. He was just kind of too big. But we started hanging out, and I remember we actually started making, like, little movies together, kind of. We made, like, very strange, like, Star Wars spoof, and we made kind of like this like Blues Brothers-y Pulp Fiction type spoof, and that was when we were pretty young. I mean, that's when we were like 12 years old, and then pretty soon after that I like started doing stand-up comedy, and just kind of the notion of writing and doing that kind of thing seemed less, you know, foreign to us, and we just decided to try to write a movie.
Well, didn't you write the first draft of Superbad when you were 15 with Evan Goldberg?
We started younger. We started when we were around 13, writing it, maybe 14. I'm a little older than he is, like only like 6 months. But like when I was 14, he was 13. I think we started around then, though.
So the movie wasn't made until you were in your 20s, and by then you were too old to play the part that you had written for yourself. But yeah. Were there things that remained in from when you were 13 or 14 and you started writing it?
Yeah, a ton of it remained in. I would say, like, the general structure of the movie, like the series of events, is very similar, ultimately, in the final movie, to what it was when we first wrote it. You know, the idea that it's these two guys, and they want to get girls, and there's a party, and they get asked to buy the alcohol, and another one of their friends gets a fake ID that says McLovin, and he gets caught, and they get caught up with these cops. I mean, that was always, you know, from when, you know, we were 13, 14 years old, that's what happened. What wasn't there, though, was the relationship between the Seth and Evan characters. The fact that, you know, they were going to college and they were breaking up and they were going to different colleges and they felt weird about that. That was all stuff that was added as we got older and a little smarter and, you know, we realized more, you know, what made a good movie. And ultimately, you know, that's what the movie's about. And we kind of wrote the movie backwards in that regard. Now that's what we would start with and kind of build everything around it. But, you know, we wrote it. We were young. We just started, you know, instantly just put in all the fun stuff and what was happening to us at parties and stuff like that and putting in stories that had happened to us. And then, you know, later we worked out the emotional side.
Well, let me play something from working out the emotional side. And it sounds like this is a scene that you added later when you were older. And this is toward the end of the movie when the Evan and Seth characters, they've been fighting a lot and getting in each other's way. But at this party where all kinds of mayhem happens. But anyways, the Evan character rescues the Seth character from this terrible situation. They're both really drunk. They sleep side by side in sleeping bags, and the Evan character, played by Michael Cera, has this to say to the Seth character, played by Jonah Hill.
I can't believe you saved me. You saved me. I can't believe... I owe you so much. You cared. I love you. I love you, man.
I love you. I love you. I'm not even embarrassed to say it. I love you.
I'm not embarrassed.
Love you.
I love you. It's like, why don't we say that every day? Why can't we say it more often?
I just love you. I just want to go to the rooftops and scream, I love my best friend, Evan.
We should go up on my roof.
For sure.
Like when you went away for Easter on your vacation... I missed you.
I missed you, too.
I want the world to know. It's the most beautiful thing in the world.
Boop, boop, boop. Come here. Come here, man.
And that's the Seth character giving the Evan character a big hug.
Yes.
So it's a very uncharacteristically emotional scene for these two characters. And they're very embarrassed in the morning when they wake up next to each other.
It's like they slept to each other.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So where did that scene come from? Had you had emotional moments like that with Evan or any other male friend?
Never, ever in a million. Never. Man, not with Evan for sure. I mean, I've never had something like, you know, drunk people have tried to do that to me and I instantly shut it off. And just say, don't do this, dude. You'll feel terrible about this later. I'll bring it up all the time. I'll make fun of you. I'll constantly bring up that night you got drunk and told me you love me. Just don't. Just save yourself the embarrassment and don't do it. To us, you know, these male friendship stories are just funny, you know. Evan describes it funny. I only heard him say this recently, but he thinks a lot of it came from when we grew up in Vancouver. You know, our friends were, I don't know if I'd say callous, but we had a very, you know, harsh relationship with one another. We constantly make fun of each other. You know, emotions, you know, really were not welcome there. You know, there was no room to get your feelings hurt. You just kind of hung out and everything. You know, we knew everyone was joking, but, you know, everyone had really thick skin, I would say. And then I moved to L.A. and everyone's actors here and writers and everyone's like super emotional and super in touch with their feelings. And it seemed like every 2 weeks one of my friends was coming to me and be like, you hurt my feelings the other day, dude. And I'd be like, what are you talking about? What? And You know, it was funny that Evan pointed that out, and I really think that probably has a lot to do with where it came from, where why we're just so fascinated and amused by these, you know, male relationships. You know, to us, there's just nothing funnier than, like, a guy awkwardly explaining to another guy that he's hurt his feelings and then later awkwardly, you know, forgiving him for doing that.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Seth Rogen. He co-wrote and stars in the new comedy Pineapple Express, about two stoners on the run from hitmen. Rogen also co-starred in The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up, and co-wrote and co-starred in Superbad. He got his start as a teenager in the TV series Freaks and Geeks, which premiered in 1999. You've played several characters who are kind of clueless about women and what women or girls really want and who they really are. So I thought I'd play a scene like that from 40-Year-Old Virgin. And this is a scene where you're giving advice to Steve Carell, the 40-Year-Old Virgin, and he lacks the confidence to approach women. So here's your pep talk.
Look at me. Looks are not important. Really look at me. I am ugly as f*** by traditional standards, but I get with women. Aren't you curious as to how that's possible?
I am not ugly as f***.
I didn't say you were ugly as
f***. Well, you implied it.
Okay. It doesn't matter if you're ugly as f*** or you're ugly as f***. It's about talking to women, and I know how to do that because I observe, because I am a novelist.
What? You never told me that before.
That's because I'm not an arrogant prick, Andy. Okay? The problem most men have is they don't know how to talk to women.
You know what my problem is? I am not interesting. What am I supposed to say? I went to magic camp? I'm an accomplished ventriloquist? Oh, I am a seventh degree imperial yo-yo master. Oh, do me, yo-yo master. I want you to do me because you're the yo-yo guy.
Are you done? Listen, the problem most men have is they just plain straight up have no clue how to talk to women.
You just ask questions, okay? That's it. Because women do not care about what you have to say at all, anyway, you know? And all they want to do is talk about themselves. So you're just going to let them do that, okay? So remember, questions, be cool, and be kind of a d***. You know, here, be David Caruso in Jade.
Okay. I know exactly what you're talking about.
You do. That's good.
That's my guest Seth Rogen and Steve Carell in a scene from 40-Year-Old Virgin. Now, I have to say, you grew up in Vancouver. Yeah. You've described your parents as radical Jewish socialists. So I have to assume that your parents tried to bring you up in an enlightened atmosphere where you learned to respect women and treat them
yes,
as equals.
Yes, very much so. Yes.
Which your characters never know how to do. So
no, not at all. But I feel like I feel like the reason I have the insight to know that that's funny to watch is because I know how wrong it is, you know. And I also feel like that's kind of why we can get away with it, is because you can tell that we're, you know, hopefully most people can tell that we're not actually like that, that we're showing these guys as idiots and that we think they're wrong. And that's the joke of the scene, is it's not look how great this guy's advice is. It's look at what a moron he is.
So what are some of the things your mother taught you about how to behave around women or how to treat women?
Oh, just always be extremely respectful was something that was drilled into me, which I think probably prevented me from having sex for a good 7 years longer than it should have. I mean, you know, some of my friends would lie to girls to get them or do things, you know, that were cheat on girls. That was just never in the realm of what was something that, you know, was instilled in me, you know? Yeah, I mean, my mom's a social worker, for God's sakes. I mean, it's always, when it came to, like, appropriate behavior towards one another, it was, I was well-versed.
So you moved to L.A. when you were 17, maybe?
Yeah.
Were you graduated from high school yet?
Nope. It was the summer going into my senior years when I moved.
What? Why did you move? You ended up working on Freaks and Geeks, but you didn't have.
I moved because I got
yet,
no. I did. I got cast on that from Vancouver.
Oh.
They did like casting sessions like all over North America, in Chicago, New York, and Toronto, and I went to the Vancouver one, and so I moved to L.A. with a job.
Wow, that's amazing. So, what was the audition like?
It was. You know what's funny is the audition scene was actually a guy that it was a scene that Judd wrote, and it was about a guy saying he wanted to grow pot in an underground bunker. And if anyone came, he could blow it all up and just say he was a farmer. And that Judd wrote that scene, and that is actually where the idea for Pineapple Express came from.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
Let me play a scene from Freaks and Geeks. And this is, a series set in high school, which also starred James Franco, who's in Pineapple Express with you. This is one of the episodes that you were prominently featured in. And you were with a girl who plays tuba, and you're starting to date, and she's about to hit you with a really big surprise.
This isn't really that uncommon. But when I was born, I had the potential to be male or female.
Yeah, me too.
No, I mean, I was born with both male and female parts.
Uh-huh.
My parents made a decision with the doctors that I should be a girl. I mean, thank God, because that's who I am. But it's still a really big part of my life. And I thought you should know.
No, this is good that you told me this.
Are you freaking out?
No. You're all girl now.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, it's okay, It's, if I was dating you when you were just born, things might be a little different, because, that's dumb. But, no, you're all girl now, so it's okay.
Thanks, Ken.
Yeah, I had my appendix out, so, I've been there.
That's Seth Rogen in a scene from Freaks and Geeks. How did this episode end up being based around your character?
From very early on, this was an idea that they had. John Kasdan, who's the brother of Jake Kasdan, was a writer for who directed the pilot of Freaks and Geeks and several episodes, including that one, actually, was a writer for the show. And very early on in the show, he came up to me and was like, he has this really kind of weird voice. He's like, hey, I got an idea for an episode where you're dating a hermaphrodite. And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, and it'll show your character's really sensitive. And I was like, okay. okay, whatever, sure. And I just didn't think that they would ever get around to it. And then lo and behold, they actually did it. And they apparently had a hard time writing the episode. And that was the first time Judd really brought me and the actress into his office and just said, improvise the scene. Let's see what happens. And what we used ultimately was totally improvised, if I recall.
Oh, the appendix line is really funny. Was that yours?
Yeah, thanks.
It must have been an amazing experience at the age of 17 to suddenly be on a show like Freaks and Geeks. And even though it wasn't a commercial success, it was a big cult success, and I bet it's still popular on DVD. And that's where you met Judd Apatow, who you're still working with. I mean, you've had such incredible successes together. So can you talk a little bit about what it was like to suddenly go from, like, high school kid to suddenly being a co-star on an American TV series at the age of 17?
It was amazing. What's funny about that time when I think back on it is how – it's actually kind of scary – how little thought I put into the actual, quality of the show. Like, I didn't think it was a bad show necessarily, but I don't remember – at the beginning, especially, like, putting any thought at all into whether or not it was a good or bad show. I think I was just so ecstatic that I was working and that, I didn't have to go to high school anymore, even though, I had a lot of good friends there and I didn't have a bad experience. But it just looked like finally, I had a, there was a career that was beginning. And I think I was just so excited about that I really... I don't remember thinking that much at all at first. Is this a good show or a bad show? I honestly didn't care. And then as it went on, I started to really appreciate that it was good and that we were doing something a little different and that, everyone was really cool to work with and that it was a really talented group of people. And it was kind of just when I was realizing that, that it got canceled.
When Freaks and Geeks was canceled, how did you end up continuing to work with Judd Apatow?
You know, it was pretty random how it went down from my perspective. I really didn't hear much from him for a while. I sent him the script for Superbad. I don't even think he ever read it. And I auditioned. I was just auditioning for stuff. I had a small part in this movie, Donnie Darko, with Jake Gyllenhaal. And, you know, not, it wasn't going that great, though. And then I literally got a call out of nowhere one day that Judd was doing this new show about college called Undeclared. Well, no, it didn't have a name, but he was doing like a college show, and that he wanted me to come in and be a writer on it. And it was like literally just out of nowhere. It was like that. It was like, hey, come in and be a writer. Okay. And next thing I knew, I was working on Undeclared.
And Undeclared lasted even a shorter time than Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah, it was one episode less, I think.
So then you were out in the cold again. And
exactly.
And ended up making movies with Judd Apatow. But I guess at that point, you knew you had something going together.
Not really. There was a big downtime between Undeclared and, I mean, Undeclared ended in 2001, and 40-Year-Old Virgin wasn't made till 2005, I think. So there was a good 4 years there where I did almost absolutely nothing. And it was bad, you know. Yeah, I just didn't work at all for a really long time. Me and Jason Segel wrote a pilot together with Jack Black for HBO when it didn't get picked up, and slowly, you know, I started getting more work. I wrote for the Ally G show in there, but it was not until 40-Year-Old Virgin that thing really picked up again in any way that seemed reliable.
Were you depressed during that period?
I don't know if I'd say I was depressed. I was probably too stoned to realize if I was. yeah, I mean, there was definitely, I think I was angry more than depressed. I think I was just kind of bitter. I got very bitter about Hollywood and just the whole thing, you know, I mean, we had written Pineapple Express and we had written Superbad, and at that time they really weren't that different than they are now, and I just felt like these are good movies. Why can't we get them made? You know, I always believed in them. I never doubted that. I never start to think like maybe we're just not good. It was always, you know, why aren't they giving us our shot? And so yeah, I just remember being angry.
Now let me ask you about Knocked Up.
Yes.
In which you play a very unenlightened guy who has a kind of drunken, you're drunk at a bar, and a very attractive woman is drunk at the bar too. She's an anchor for a local station, and you end up sleeping together for one night. And actually, let me play a clip from the movie. And this is like the morning after. It's like the day after you're meeting in a coffee shop.
Yeah.
After you slept together, and you're both like really uncomfortable.
I just yacked. Something nasty. I feel way better, though. I think that's like the secret. Like, you gotta, I mean, once you're hungover, you just gotta puke. Feels so, did you puke?
No.
You can't. I don't think it's gross.
Oh, that's okay. I'm fine. Okay. Some coffee, so.
You know, the best thing for a hangover is weed. Do you smoke weed?
Not really.
You don't?
No.
At all?
Mm-mm.
Like in the morning?
No, I just don't.
You know, it is like the best medicine. Because it fixes everything. Jonah broke his elbow once. We just got high and it still clicks, but, I mean, he's okay.
Right.
Yeah. Last night was great. What I remember of it.
Right, yeah.
Well, it turns out, as most of our listeners probably know, that she's pregnant from this one-night stand that you've had together, and she decides to keep the baby, and then you're in the position of having to figure out what the heck to do, and you end up actually falling in love with each other. So, you know, a lot of people's reaction to the movie was, there's no way she would have had this baby. You know, she's just started this, like, new job. She's so into her career. There's no way she'd have this baby. And you and she are so different. There's no way that she'd actually stay with your character because you guys have nothing in common. So what's your reaction to that response?
I don't know. I mean, she does keep the baby. I mean, to me, that's a weird issue that there's no way she would keep this baby. I mean, I don't think this character is the first person in the history of the universe to get pregnant and keep the baby. I mean, people do that. If she didn't keep the baby, it'd be a pretty short movie. So, you know, we just didn't tell that story. To me, you know, when there's movies that are about, you know, guys named Hellboy and, you know, the issue that they have with our movie is that she doesn't get an abortion. I mean, there's greater suspensions of disbelief that are made on a daily basis among moviegoers. And as far as, you know, she would never fall in love with me, I mean, I feel like that's what the movie's about. I mean, either you buy it or you don't. And, you know, either one is fine with me. But it's, I mean, that's what it is. I mean, that's the journey. It's that she does, you know, we do slowly fall in love with each other. So either the movie works for you or it doesn't. I mean, and that's, you know, that's up for debate.
Well, I have to ask you about writing for Ali G. And this is the Sacha Baron Cohen show in which he interviewed in character. He interviewed real people who didn't know that this was just a character. They didn't know that the Ali G show was just like a put on. And he'd interview like real political figures who were clueless about this. So what was it like to be a writer on that show? What was the job, writing questions for the interviews?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. We would write the interview questions and think of people that he could maybe interview also as part of it. But that it was mostly writing the interview questions. And, you know, you try to predict what the other people would say. I mean, it's a lot easier when it's people who, you know, deserve it. And, you know, when you get someone who's job it is to convert gay people into straight people, it's easy to think of questions making fun of them, because that's kind of a terrible thing to do, you know. When I first actually heard that we had the opportunity to work on it, I didn't even want to try. I just assumed that I just like that guy's really smart, we can't do that. But slowly he kind of taught us the thought process needed in order to really do it effectively.
So what's one of the best questions you wrote?
There was one funny thing we did, I think, where we got these guys to do all this, you know, all these guys on spring break to do somewhat homoerotic stuff. You know, there was a drunk wrestling team and got them to do push-ups and wrestle each other. And I mean, it is like the gayest stuff you could ever be doing, what these guys are doing. And then at the end, the character goes, "Now say hello, tell them, now say hello to our audience and say, I love being on gay TV." And and they just completely lost it, even though, like, I mean, what they were doing, it didn't change what they did in the first place, but they completely got furious and completely flew off the handle. And it was a proud moment for us, I thought.
Could you put your finger on anything in particular that you learned about comedy from working with Sacha Baron Cohen?
I mean, a lot. I don't know if I could necessarily put my finger on it. I mean, what I did learn is if you think really hard, odds are it will be funnier. He really works hard, that guy. It's a difficult job to work on that show. The hardest job I've had. It's an extremely intellectually challenging process. So it was just a good lesson in work ethic in general, I would say.
It was great to talk with you. I really want to thank you a lot.
Thank you very much for having me.
Seth Rogen co-wrote and stars in the new film Pineapple Express. It opens next week. Cincinnati is one of America's hidden musical cities, having produced some of the best popular music of the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Its heroes tend not to be well known, and one of the most elusive is the guitar player Lonnie Mack. Rock historian Ed Ward tells his story.
On March 12, 1963, Lonnie Mack, an imposing bear-like guitarist, was doing what he did, playing guitar in a recording studio in Cincinnati. He was scheduled for three sessions that day, one with a girl group, Gigi and the Charmaines, and the others by Max Falcon and Kenny Patton Smith. Somewhere in there, he picked up his signature Gibson Flying V guitar, and he and studio band slid into a jam based on Chuck Berry's Memphis. They were recording in King Record Studios, owned by Cincinnati's main record label, but they were recording for Fraternity, a smaller label that picked up artists King didn't want and hadn't had a hit in years. For some reason, Fraternity took this informal jam, pressed it up, and just a few months later, Lonnie Mack found himself in the top 10. At the time, Lonnie was 22 years old, having been born in 1941 in rural Ohio and brought up in Indiana. His mother bought him a $10 guitar when he was six and taught him a few chords, and the course of his life was fixed. After an argument with a teacher in sixth grade, he dropped out of school and joined a country band fronted by someone named Hoot Smith. By the time he cut Memphis, Lonnie was a 9-year veteran of Cincinnati's bars and honky-tonks and had recorded a couple of forgettable singles before becoming a guitarist for hire. In fact, when Memphis became a hit, he was on the road backing singer Troy Seals and had to rush back to Cincinnati to record a follow-up. It was another instrumental called Wham, and it didn't do as well. But to Lonnie, just focusing on his instrumental prowess was missing half the point. He'd picked up a lot of songs in his life, and he knew he could sing. He was right. There was a small problem. Back then, nobody expected such a soulful voice from a white guy. I Apologize wasn't released in 1963 when it was recorded, but other vocals were, and neither country nor rhythm and blues radio would play them, let alone pop radio. At least Fraternity believed in Lonnie, and his constant touring meant that between local hits, sales of records to jukeboxes, and live appearances, he did okay. He was cutting more instrumentals than he'd have liked, but one of them made him a legend in England. His 1966 version of King Curtis' Soul Serenade became the theme song of a popular BBC show and made guitarists all over Britain wonder how he got that sound. It was played through a speaker made for an electric organ, called a Leslie, they discovered. Fraternity Records wasn't doing too well, and eventually expired early in 1967. But American record companies were looking for American guitar heroes, and Elektra Records found Lonnie and signed him up. It must have seemed like a great idea, someone who could sing soul and country and play a mean guitar. And in fact, he cut 3 albums for them, the first of which came out in early 1969.
Well, I went to the place where we used to go. The doorman was there. He met me at the door. I know who you are, yeah, and who you're looking for. She don't come here anymore.
His stint at Elektra also found him on, of all places, a Doors album, Morrison Hotel, where on Roadhouse Blues, Jim Morrison can be heard urging him on.
Let it roll, baby, roll. Let it roll, baby, roll. Let it roll, baby, roll. Let it roll. All night long. Do it, Robbie, do it.
But his records weren't selling, so in 1971, Elektra dropped him. Capitol tried to market him as a country artist during the 70s, but got nowhere. In 1983, though, a young guitarist who'd had some success and who'd picked up the guitar after hearing Memphis as a little boy convinced Lonnie to let him produce an album. The fact that it was Stevie Ray Vaughan meant that the album, Strike Like Lightning, got noticed, and Lonnie's career picked up again, only to peter out once more in 1988 when changes at his latest record company, Epic, sank his first album for them. Today, Lonnie Mack lives in the hills of Tennessee, making rare live appearances and selling his music via his website at lonniemack.com. He's even got a MySpace page. Something tells me this story's not over yet.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. I'm Terry Gross, and I'm happy and sad to end the show with news about our associate producer, Patty Leswing. Happy for her because she's just gotten a great job working for a great radio program. Sad because that means she's leaving our show. But add another point in the happy column because Patty's only going down the hall where she'll be a producer of Radio Times, which is produced here at WHYY. I want to thank her for the work she's done making me and my guests sound better through the magic of editing, and for all her help behind the scenes holding things together. It's always been fun talking with her about music, even more fun when I've gotten a chance to hear her sing. She's good. That's why we're going to close with a recording she made with the band The Get Arounds. Patty, good luck on your new job, and thanks for staying close by.